This is Jeff Chrisman, and I'm here today at the Art Hall in Uptown on 23rd in Oklahoma City, talking with local musician Jared Lowry. Jared, thanks so much for taking the time, man.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff.
I appreciate it. Man, I tell you what, I'm sitting here. This is an interesting experience because this is the first time I've interviewed a musician having seen them perform just the night before. And I'm sitting here thinking to myself that, man, what a night that was. I'm just, you know, sitting here thinking about what it was like. I'd never been to that venue, to Café do Brasil, there upstairs, the Caipirinha Bar, and sitting outside, literally being able to see, you know, the entire downtown skyline, you know, you and Dave and you guys doing your thing, and man, what an experience that was.
No, thank you, man. I appreciate it. Yeah, it was a cool little venue. I'm doing this little duet with Carl Moore in Stillwater quite a bit, and so Carl Victor Moore, he's this local kind of jazz pianist. He's a kind of smooth jazz R&B. He can do anything really, but he had this idea of maybe doing a duet at the Café do Brasil or the Bossa Nova Lounge up there, and it kind of turned into more of like, hey, Café do Brasil wanted him to play downstairs, and maybe Jared can get a band together and play upstairs. And so I decided, the project that I'm involved in, you know, We Eat Last, it's, you know, I can talk to them and maybe we could get a trio or something together. And so I called Dave. Dave was like, yeah, man, I'm down. And, you know, and then Joe Richard, I've known him through a project I worked with last year.
Oh, okay.
And so that's how I knew him, and he's a guitarist too, but he also plays bass.
Interesting.
He's really good on both of them. He's a really talented guy, and another straight ahead jazz kind of person. He's also a professor. He's a guitar instructor at a university over here.
Oh, interesting.
Too. Yeah, I can't remember the name of it, but it's. Actually, I think it's a math and school sciences area.
Oh, yeah. I think
that's what it's called. Yeah, it's somewhere here in the city. But you know, Joe teaches there.
Oh, wow.
I've known him for a while. And so I called him up and was like, hey, you want to do this gig up on the rooftop up here? And he said, sure, you know. and then when you left afterwards, you know, Carl came and joined us on the second set. And then the bass player from Local Mandarins Everything, Eric Harris, he came up and jammed too.
Wow, man. What was that like? I mean,
it was great. You know, Eric Harris, he's incredibly, all those guys in Local Mandarins Everything are just incredibly talented musicians. Like, they're just incredibly talented. And what they're doing is so unique, like, as far as for, like, the world of you know, fusion music goes and, you know, improvised music goes, or jazz fusion, whatever you want to call it. You know, what they're doing is just, like, so unique, like, here in the city. Like, when I first heard them, I was just like, oh, I want to do that. You know, because, they were playing one of my favorite tunes from the Tony Williams Lifetime Believe It album, which was Fred. You know, I'm a big Alan Holdsworth freak. And so, you know, when they were playing Fred and they just nailed it, I'm just like, I don't think anybody here in Oklahoma even knows that that album exists or even knows that song exists. Because, you know, I've told you, like, I felt like that album was just one of the most influential, like, you know, fusion-esque, you know, where it's like, you know, because, you know, like I was telling you, like, you know, fusion really kind of went into, like, this, you know, smooth jazz, R&B kind of route. But the guys in the 70s were really going towards a lot more, like, you know, like, you had Mahavishnu Orchestra, which was really going towards, like, Eastern music and stuff like that, Carnatic music.
Yeah.
And incorporating that Eastern style music with the Western style music that they had. And we're finding ways to make improvisational vehicles using, you know, Eastern music. And they even brought in Eastern musicians. That's what's really cool. It's like biomolecular fusion in a way.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it's like they had their world and their world, they brought it together. And Weather Report kind of did the same thing.
Oh,
it's like,
man,
you know,
yes.
Joe Zawinul was really into a lot of the Zimbabwe African choirs and stuff like that. And then Jaco Pastorius was into an array of things, you know, a lot of, like, the big band soul jazz stuff. That's how that tune, The Chicken, came out. There's an intro. It's called the soul intro.
Yeah,
before the chicken plays, and it's just like this big band thing. And so Jaco talked a lot about how he was just really into, like, the Saturday Night Live big band
sounds. Man.
Yes. So he was really into that. And so that's the cool, to me, like, the fusion music is just really just like a representation of yourself in a way. You know, it's there's no genre thing attached to it. It's just, you know, this is my music. This is kind of how I feel about music, and this is what I'm bringing to you. And that's kind of how I feel about, like, with my own stuff. And,
yeah.
And then, like, when I look at, like, you know, Local Manners, everything, that's what they're doing. Like, they, you know, Jay Gleason, great guy, amazing player, great friend. He's this really amazing shredder. And then, you know, Eric Harris came from kind of a jazz background and everything. And, you know, he's playing the bass and stuff like that. And just, you know, killing all the, and has his own influences that he's bringing into it. And then Chops Collins, you know, he came from kind of like that, you know, jazz background. And then, you know, he's just destroying on the drums. So they all bring their own unique kind of experiences together into this cohesive, like, musical experience and expression.
Oh,
which,
yeah,
is just really awesome, you know, to have that kind of, because what ends up happening is that when you really stay true to yourself, and I've learned this, you, and as a composer, you the originality comes out.
Yeah,
you know, it's, and you know when you stay true to yourself and you don't compromise. A lot of guys compromise, like they're like, you know, well, I'm gonna just, you know, play a couple of tunes that everybody knows, which is okay. I mean, you know, you should, but within reason, you know, I think that it's okay to say, you know, I want to give the people kind of what I do too, and that's kind of what we did last night. Or if we do something that everybody knows, you know, we're gonna just do it our own way, you know.
Oh yeah,
and that's kind of what I was doing last night when we were playing, like, some of those standards. That's why I was looking around. I was like, I was hoping that none of the jazz guys would, like, come after me, because we were doing some, you know, we were playing the standards, but we were just making it really weird.
it was incredible, man.
Oh, thanks, man.
It was almost like, it felt like you're, and I don't want to stop your train of thought at all,
no.
But it's like, the thing that came to mind to me was that it was like you guys were carving out some space. It was almost like there was, you know, the space in which, and unfortunately my memory is not as good as it used to be, so trying those standards, I know them well, but it's like I couldn't necessarily tell you the name of those.
Yeah.
But it was, I recognized them immediately, but then all of a sudden it's like, all right, I think I know what this is, but it's like, oh my goodness, man, it's just, there's almost like you guys were carving out this really unique space that had never existed before, and I think it was amplified by the feeling of being outside on a second floor balcony with huge panoramic view.
Oh, my. Okay.
And that's really what, I mean, and I apologize, it was okay to reject this, but it's just like, man, that's really what it felt like. Like, you guys were creating something that just had never existed before.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it. That's kind of, you know, like I said, I really think that, you know, once when everybody just is kind of, like, true to themselves, like, that's where the originality comes out. And, you know, because I learned a long time ago, in 2014, I was coming up with this original music and stuff like that, and it's just like nobody was really giving it a shot. I think what bothers me more is, like, when people, not that people don't like it, but, like, they don't, like, give it a chance. Like, that's what kind of, like, makes me, like, you know. So I caved in, I compromised, and I wrote this. It was a joke. It was a tune that was so easy, and I sang on it. And it was kind of like a folky singer-songwriter thing. And everybody loved it. And, like, my town and my community, and they loved it. And I was like, are you kidding? It was a joke, you know? Like, I didn't mean for it to be, like, to be appreciated. Like, it was literally just a joke, you know?
Oh, wow.
But then I got asked to play it. And, you know, for some money. And a lot of money. And so I was like, oh, I really don't want to do this, but okay, I guess I will. And I got up and I played, and I was strumming the guitar and playing these chords and stuff, and then singing at the same time. And I remember feeling like, this is not me.
Wow.
Like, this is just not who I am. And so I learned a big lesson that day. I was just like, you know what? I'm not going to compromise. I compromising within reason and within a way that's, like, still true to yourself, I think, is one thing. But compromising completely and saying, you know, okay, I'll do it exactly the way it is on the record, exactly how you want me to do it, I think that's where it can get a little damaging to the art, in my humble opinion.
Yeah.
You know, and so I learned a lesson that way. And but anyway, I don't know, where we, you know, do we start from, you know, kind of, do you want me to kind of tell you who, where I come from.
Yeah, that would be great. Actually, okay. Just to hear, yeah, absolutely, to kind of hear how you know how you got started, influence. You know, I know you talked about some of your influences with Tony Williams, and
yeah.
So yeah, it'd be great to kind of just hear, you know, kind of get, kind of take a look back and kind of see, you know, how you got here, where you are right now.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Cool. I did. Yeah, I wasn't sure how the process works.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we're just gonna, it's almost kind of like a jazz tune. It just kind of
just goes and flow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great. Let's see. I started playing guitar when I was about 9 years old. I heard Carlos Santana when I was 9, and I was just like, okay, that's what I want to do.
Oh, man.
So my dad had an acoustic guitar in his closet, and he played acoustic guitar, and he taught me just like 4 chords, D, A, G, C, you know. And then when I was about 11, we got the internet, and on the internet, I was looking up. We had this little friendly competition in high school, you know, which was, you know, I was about 16 then, but like, I got the internet, so I started studying, like, I started looking at, like, classic rock tunes and everything, because there was this thing, there's, like, this little friendly competition in high school, where I was going in Chandler, where anybody that could play these old classic rock tunes, you know, would be the coolest guy in the school, or something like that. So, I was playing, like, Bachman Turner Overdrive, you know, and stuff like that, and just trying to, you know, just trying to kind of, like, compete and everything, and not really compete, but just try to, like, impress my friends and stuff, you know, as a kid, you know. But, you know, I got turned about 16, and I was playing with some local bands in the Chandler, Lincoln County area, because I'm from Lincoln County, I live in Stroud. And so I started from there and basically just played with churches. I played with, you know, local bands and stuff like that in the area. Didn't really gig much, though. I wasn't really gigging at that time when I was 16, because I'm 16. But I also played with the Chandler High School jazz band, too.
Oh, wow.
But I was also in marching band, too, playing cornet. And so that's kind of where I learned a little bit of how to read some sheet music and stuff like that. I'm not really good at it now. I have to, like, really, it takes me like 2 hours to read notation to where I can, like, get it to figured out, you know, kind of where the, you know, what it is. But I can get there. I just need to sit. I just need to sit down and just, like, spend some time with it, you know. But so anyway, in the jazz band thing, and you know, we were playing, you know, like Killer Joe. We were playing all those old, you know, standard, you know, kind of standards, you know, big band stuff. And I remember, like, when I was about 17 or 18, I started getting really into, like, heavy metal. Like, I was starting to really dig into, like, the Shredders. Like,
oh, yeah.
Like, Yngwie Malmsteen and Steve Vai. And I was getting really into, and, you know, Michelangelo Badio, the guy that plays the X guitar with both hands. And, you know, I was, you know, as a kid, it was, like, really a big thing for me. So I started really kind of, like, trying to figure out what they were doing, the fast picking and everything. And I just kind of started really getting into theory, like music theory in itself. And so I asked my band director about chords and triads. You know, what's a triad? You know, what's an arpeggio? What's a scale? You know, the basics, you know. And so he kind of got frustrated with me, because it's like, well, this is stuff you should already know because you're in marching band. But I was 16. I really wanted to play guitar. I really didn't want to play the trumpet in marching band, but. You know, so we rehashed it, and you know, he showed me a couple of things, and then I just realized on the guitar, like, it's just like, you know, the notes are all there, you know, and visualizing, you know, the whole scale is on all the frets, and on each string, each individual fret. And so I got into college about 2010, and in 2010 I was, you know, was going to a little college in Seminole. And in Seminole, there was a band program, and it was a band, but it was like a tuition waiver. So I auditioned for it, and I got the part. I got the lead guitar part for it. And at that time, I was playing some Malmsteen stuff and everything, but I was just really into, like, metal. That's just what I was really into. And I started messing around with, like, I'm just going to, you know, come up with a funk tune, and I make a funk tune. And solo over it, you know, and just make up solos. And I'm just like, okay, this is fun, you know. This is kind of fun, this spontaneous thing that I'm just doing just off the top of my head. This is kind of cool, because I'm going back and I'm looking at the recordings that I make on my phone. And I'm like, okay, that sounds pretty decent, you know, that sounds okay. And so it was an interesting experience. But I think there was one guitar player in Buckethead that I was really digging a lot. And he was doing this crazy, like, atonal tapping and everything that was just out there, just really out there kind of metal music, you know. I never heard anything like that before, because he was doing some of the funk stuff too. I mean, he'd play some like funky kind of stuff, but then he would just like this really like headbanger, like hardcore metal thing going on.
Wow.
And then, you know, and then he would do this stuff that was just out there. Like, I'm like, it almost sounds mechanical. Like, it sounds like computerized.
Interesting.
And so there's a funny story with Buckethead, because, Buckethead led me into a guy named Sean Lane. Sean Lane was a fusion guitarist, and he was a guy from Memphis. And Sean Lane was really into jazz. And so when I got really into Sean Lane, because I became obsessed with Sean Lane, and so I started like learning all his stuff and trying to figure out what he was doing and everything. And Sean Lane really got me in like to looking into jazz, but avant-garde, which is kind of like what Buckethead was doing, like the avant-garde aspect of what Buckethead had, that concept that he had, which is like using the bad notes and taking the notes that would make you cringe, like those minor second intervals and stuff like that, and the augmented fifths and stuff, and those crazy chords and harmonies, you know, using them in a way that's artistic, you know.
Yeah.
Even if it sounds bad, there's still value in that negative feeling.
It's a great lesson.
You know, and so there's... And a lot of people kind of like, well, if it sounds bad, then it is bad. I'm like, well, but it depends on how you look at it. It depends on how you analyze it. A lot of the jazz scholars, when Bitches Brew came out, really criticized it. They're like, I couldn't listen to it. Like, there was one guy that criticized it because he said that he just couldn't sit down and listen to it. But for guys like me and for, you know, I'm sure you...
Oh, that was life-changing.
Yeah, it was amazing. Like, it was incredible. I'd never heard anything like it, you know, at that time. And so, you know, during that time... And to find out, everything they did was improvised. Everything. They had no form. Nothing. They had no sheet music in front of them. They just were making sounds. And
wow.
Then improvising over the sounds that they created, you know, as the jazz musicians that they were. And so, it was cool. And Miles, actually, during that time, like, didn't take any... I remember in an interview reading, like, he didn't have... He actually purposely would try to get... he would get jazz musicians, but, like, force them to play more, like, funk and more, like, rock. And they would always talk about how uncomfortable they were doing that. Because, you know, but they didn't want to say anything to Miles because it was Miles Davis.
Yeah, you know, who tells him anything?
Yeah, and then so they were like, we didn't really want to say anything because, you know, we really loved Miles, and so, but we just felt really uncomfortable. And then, like, I think Keith Jarrett said that it was that feeling of being uncomfortable that Miles liked.
Wow, man.
And so Miles was, and that's how I discovered Miles Davis, was through one of my favorite albums is an album called Aura.
Yes,
and it's where all the tunes are named after colors, and that's because the album, I guess, was inspired by a French composer named Olivier Messiaen, which Olivier Messiaen has this condition where when he plays sounds and plays chords, he sees colors, and so that's kind of what Miles, you know, drew the inspiration from that, and then he was using the harmonic concepts that Olivier Messiaen had, which I kind of shared a little bit of that on Instagram, which is called the Modes of Limited Transpositions.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how he came up with really interesting pieces using those scales and those things. And so the world of classical music was, you know, kind of tying this into, you know, with me back then. The avant-garde thing and the fusion thing, there was just this element of, like, dissonance with that drive of rock and then that improvisational ethic of jazz, which just really kind of made me go, wow, this is kind of what I want to do.
Oh, man.
And so it made me realize, like, this is who I am, you know. And I remember the instructor that we had in the band program, he heard me play, like, this really out there. I mean, it was so dissonant. And it was just a tune that was just based in, like, the tritone interval, which is an interval that was banned in the Renaissance. Because it literally is the devil's note, is what they call it, the tritone.
Interesting.
Yeah, so anybody in that time that was caught playing the interval, they would be killed. Because,
man,
it was just, it was a very, and you know, it's just, and basically the interval is just C to F sharp, you know, that's the interval. And it's, if you have that, you know, interval where it's C and F sharp, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of voicing you're doing or kind of chord, if you just add that interval in there, they would hang you because it was considered to be the devil's note. during that time. And I can't remember what period it was in the classical realm. I don't know. I want to say Renaissance, but I don't know my classical history that well. But I think it was in that time where, you know. And then afterwards, you know, they just were like, you know, the kind of the religious aspect kind of wore off. And they're like, okay, well, we're just going to use it. And then they were making more music that way. But, you know, during college, you know, I was listening to a lot of like modern classical music and the fusion thing and everything. And then I stumbled across a composer, Arnold Schoenberg, which Arnold Schoenberg created this, the 12-tone row system, which is where you're using all the notes in the chromatic scale and you're arranging them in mismatched patterns, but every note is sounded in one measure. And so you play it like a melody or you play it like a rhythm, or you can even take them and make chords out of them and you play them at the same time. You know, this book that I have from Nicholas Slonimsky, he's got this, it's called, he developed what was called the grandmother chord.
Interesting.
And the grandmother chord contains every single note in the chromatic scale. I mean, and it's a 12-tone row, essentially. Wow. And it's just like this jarring, you know.
Oh, so it's all at once?
It's just this chord that contains it, but they're spread out. So it's like C, D, F sharp. I mean, all the notes in the chromatic scale, and then he's playing them.
Wow.
You know, because there was a chord that came before him called the mother chord, and it was developed by a composer before Slonimsky, but Slonimsky said, well, here's this chord, which is the grandmother chord, and it's older than your chord, because it's kind of in that same kind of manner. But, you know, so modern classical music was like really intriguing me. And it's just that realm of dissonance, you know. Like Olivier Messiaen was, you know, he was an ornithologist, you know, and he went outside and he had a spectrograph and he was transcribing bird songs on the spectrograph and writing the bird songs in musical notation.
Wow.
And coming up with compositions with those bird songs.
Man.
And so he was just doing a lot of really innovative stuff that, you know, nobody else was doing. And but it's dissonant. Like, it's just like when you listen to it, it's just like, oh, this is dark, or oh, this is, it conveys a negative emotion. Most people, when they hear any kind of like avant-garde kind of thing, or anything that's like, you know, serialism, is with Arnold Schoenberg, the 12-tone row thing, is usually they call it serialism. In that kind of manner, it's usually really like too much for some people to listen to because it's just so dissonant. But guys like Frank Zappa,
yeah,
you know, really liked a lot of that stuff. And then the guy that the biggest influence for me, you know, on guitar, Alan Holdsworth, really was into a lot of that. In fact, basically what I learned was that, you know, during that time was that there was this connection between classical and jazz. And I'm finding that out more and more every day. Like, there really is a connection between the modern classical realm and the jazz realm. And so, as I got older, I wanted to learn more stuff. And when I was in college, so there was a classical pianist in the school, and she was my speech teacher. But we talked, and I discovered that she was a pianist, and so we talked about some different things. And I asked her if she could show me a couple of things on the guitar, because I remember thinking to myself when I was in college, I'm like, I don't want to take lessons from a guitar player. I want to take lessons from other, you know, instrumentalists, and then apply what they have on the guitar. Because I knew where the notes were on the fretboard.
Yeah.
But to rearrange them in such a way that was musical, in a way that to where I could really kind of use them, you know, as tools or compositional devices. You know, that's what I was really focusing on in college. And so me and her sat down, and she would show me some scales and some patterns and stuff like that. And then I remember writing out a scale one time, and I said, try this out, you know, go home and try this out. And so she came back the next day for class, and she said, Jared, she's like, oh, I played that. And she said, that's really good, but try this. And then she'd add this in here. And then I would go home and try it and just blow my mind. And I'm like,
wow.
Okay, so that's how she's thinking. And so she was also like really into jazz too. And so we talked a lot about jazz, and she was just into classical and she's into jazz. And so, and then there was a saxophonist too, who I spent a little time with up there in college. And I remember I was going through this phase where I was just like, I really hate the percussive nature of the guitar. Like, I was just like, I really hate that percussiveness that the guitar has.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to play, you know, I was playing all the shreddy stuff, like, this is the crazy shred guitar thing and everything, but like, I was really digging in more to like that Alan Holdsworth approach where he was playing more like legato lines.
Yeah.
But I still kept the picking, the fast picking technique and everything, you know, during that time, but I was really getting a lot more into the legato lines and stuff like that that Holdsworth had and Sean Lane had. And so, but I remember, you know, Alan Holdsworth talking about how the reason why he did that was because he didn't like the guitar. He wanted to play a saxophone. And legato was such a much more smoother sound. And that's why he was trying to make his guitar sound like a saxophone.
Man, that's interesting.
Yeah.
No idea.
Yeah, so that's kind of why he played the way he did, because he was actually trying to sound like a horn. He really wanted a horn. He didn't want a guitar, but his parents bought him a guitar instead.
He kind of made do, so to speak.
Yeah, kind of made do, because he talked about, he was just like, you know, an instrument by its nature is just a tool, you know, to get things done.
Wow.
So he just decided, he was just like, you know, I'm just going to, you know, just do what I have in my head and just kind of play it out. But Holdsworth was really interesting for me because, you know, he really had his own world of music theory, like of how his own understanding of how he, you know, of the notes and the scales, you know, like, and to him, a C major scale, the lowest note that it started on was the lowest note that he had available on the guitar, which was the E.
Hmm.
And then the highest note that it started on, which was another E. And the whole fretboard lights up, you know, and that's how he visualizes the scale, and that's how he uses it. So it's that way in his head for every single scale.
Very interesting.
And so, and to him, you know, someone may call, you know, a C melodic minor, and he'll go, okay, I don't know what that is until you show me, and then I can see it in my head. I'm like, oh, okay, now I know what it is. So that's kind of how he, and then he actually made his own symbols for, like, you know, so this is a C melodic minor scale, you know, symbols that just, you know, when other musicians would look at it, they would be like, you know, what's, I don't even know what that is. You know, you have to explain that to me, Alan, I don't know what you're doing. So that was really cool. Like, he had his own, and because of that, he came up with just incredibly innovative things.
Oh,
just,
yeah.
Out there, like, just incredibly innovative material and music and stuff like that. But he was very much into improvisation. That's just what he was very much into. And I realized, you know, when I was in college, that's what I was into. I didn't know the set, you know, discipline of jazz, you know, and kind of the art form. But what I really enjoyed was just the fact that they were improvising. And I thought, if I can just kind of use that same concept in my world that I like, I could maybe be original and I could do something different.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And so that's kind of what I was trying to focus on. I was just trying to kind of, you know, what they call build your craft, so to speak. And so that's just kind of what I started doing. And from there, fast forwarding like to 2013, I was ready to get a band going, because I was just like, okay, I've got these originals and I felt like I had, you know, a good understanding of things. And so I sent an ad on Craigslist and found a drummer. And actually, it's 2014, and we formed a little group, a little fusion group called Tacit.
Hmm.
And that's where I think a lot of people here in the city kind of know me from, is from that band Tacit, because, you know, with Tacit, we were doing a lot of the kind of out there fusion stuff, and they're a great band. I encourage anybody to go see them. I think they're still playing. So,
oh wow!
Yeah, I left the group recently to kind of pursue other projects. But they're great people. They're great musicians. Joe is still playing with them. Carl is still playing.
Oh,
with them.
Okay.
Yeah, and so they have a saxophonist named Julie Lewis.
Who's
really good, very talented. Wow. And she was into a lot of the. Me and her were kind of into the same thing, so we really shared with each other a lot of ideas and things. And so and then the drummer Paul Hollis, he's in Edmond, and so that was Tacit. Really got me a lot of experience, like, into the scene, I guess you could say, in the business.
Yeah,
because I started in 2014 and I played all the way into now, basically, you know. And that's kind of how I got involved in the scene and everything. But the music has been different, because You know, with Tacit, it was a little bit more like that. You know, when you hear fusion, a lot of people think, you know, it's like, okay, elevator music, you know, so to speak. A lot of people think that, like, you know, kind of the Kenny G, the E, you know, which is, you know.
Totally get that.
Not really a big Kenny G fan.
Yeah, you know? I'm right there with you, man.
You know. But I mean, you know, there are people that dig him, and that's okay. But, like, it's that aspect of what they call jazz fusion, which is more of, like, smooth jazz, which is more of, like, and I love that stuff. Like, I love a lot of, like, the neo-soul, you know, stuff that's coming out now. Like, Spiral Gyro, that kind of thing. Oh, Yellow Jackets. You know, those kind of things. And that's really not a good example of, like, smooth jazz. I don't really know a whole lot of smooth jazz people. But, like, it's just really, like, you know, laid back. Because fusion, to me, when I think of fusion, I think of, like, Alan Holdsworth. I think of Mahavishnu Orchestra. I think of Weather Report. I think of that drive of rock and that improv of jazz kind of meshing together and blending beautifully.
Yeah.
So, and then just creating their own world. But what I kind of realize is that it's at the end of the day, it's not about creating a genre. It's just about, you know, just doing you, basically, you know?
Yeah. I love what you're talking. In fact, the first time I heard you at Saints, I love that phrase, creating your own world, because after growing up from a small child, you know, being exposed to a lot of this stuff, as soon as I heard you play, I think it was with you and Dave. Was it Stephen Schultz? I walked in there and you guys started. I just moved here, you know, the last couple of years, and was just now just recently starting to get familiar with the guys on the scene. And I heard just immediately, and I think I was trying to remember. I can't remember if you did Analog Earth that night, but I know that you definitely did Zeta Reticuli.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
And it's so interesting now because I couldn't, you know, I'm not a musician. I don't really know a lot about music theory. But when I heard that, what you were doing with the guitar, and I don't even know what you call it, but I feel like today you've talked about it to the point that I understand it intuitively. But it was like you're talking about the fact that there, you know, some of what you were doing in that song, unless I'm mistaken, that some of it was not percussive. I don't know if I'm right about that.
Yeah.
And I don't know if there's the dissonance that you're speaking of. Mm-hmm. There again, I'm almost like tiptoeing into this because I know what I'm talking about. But man, that literally blew my mind. I mean, I had not heard anything quite like this. You know, maybe like as a kid, you know, listen to some Matheny, but it was not exactly like Matheny. It's not, you know, it's not Pat Matheny, but it's like, man, this is fresh. This is original. This is, I knew that.
Thank you. Yeah. The you probably heard the swells and everything, like the,
yes.
that it's kind of pad like, and that's a Holdsworth thing. Alan does that a lot. And I didn't do that just to be like Alan Holdsworth, even though I have a headless guitar. But I did it because it just, you know, it's almost orchestral.
Yes.
You know, it's almost got that, or it's kind of classical-ish, you know, in a way. And so, and the harmonies were, those first couple of chords are slash chords, which, you know, I've realized that, you know, in classing, in the kind of the modern classical scene, a lot of slash chords, because I looked at chords from jazz, and you know, you get like D minor 7, you get G7, and you get C major 7, and that whole chord progression is called a 2-5-1.
Or
you can get A minor, D to G and C, and that's a 6-2-5-1. So they base the chords based on the position within the scale, you know, diatonically, so to speak. I think it's that, if I'm saying that correctly, it's how I understand it.
Yeah.
But in the classical realm, they use that. But there's also this aspect of, and this is kind of what Alan Holdsworth did, where he didn't really think much about the chords anymore. He just thought about the scales, because the chords come from the scales. So he just would look at the scale, and then he would say, you know, here's this interval, and this interval. And he talked about how he came up with these tunes, and he had a melody in his head, tried to figure out where the melody came from within the scale, and then he would just harmonize that with the notes that he had and the voicings that he had. That's why when you see him play, he has these big, giant stretches, because he's getting those intervals that are, you know, and that's another reason why he was so innovative, because he would play these chords that were just so, like, stretchy, like, you get tendonitis even trying it. And that's kind of what I started, you know, messing around with Holdsworth stuff. There's some stuff I have on Instagram where I've kind of messed around with some of the Holdsworth tunes, like 16 Minute Pain, and then I tried to kind of emulate what he was doing and kind of put that into my own world.
Yeah.
And just because, not to be like a copy of him, But just, you know, there are things that he does that, you know, it's like, okay, I'm going to take a couple of things here and there and then just kind of, you know, just kind of make my own thing with it.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, because I like what he was doing. And to me at that time, I was really trying to come up with music to where, like, the head or the theme, like in a jazz piece, was more or less like a chordal thing. You know, it was more like based on chords and single note melodies.
Yeah.
You know, like if you listen to a jazz piece that's like Groovin' High, like, you know, Dizzy Gillespie, the head is, you know,
yeah,
you know, so that's the head. So, uh-huh. So they play that before they get into the solos, and they'll play that afterwards. But in Zeta Reticuli, for example, it's a chord progression.
Man, but, so I love it.
But there's a melody to it, you know. It's like ba 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 ba. You know, there's a melody to it. So it's that's kind of what I was really focusing on. And you just get like this. It sounds to me, it just sounds orchestral in a way. That's the best way I can describe it, which is what I really try to focus on. So, and thank you for buying the albums. And,
oh man, I'm telling you, I highly recommend anybody that's listening to this, if you. You know, it's this is incredible for me to hear you talk about this, because now it's like, and I've been so interested in understanding, you know what goes into this and why this, why your sound is the way that it is. So, I mean, I feel so incredibly grateful to be able to do this. But I think I would highly recommend being able to actually, and in fact, Analog Earth. I mean, I heard, I think Zeta Reticuli is probably the first song of yours I heard. And what's weird is since last night, I've literally been like hearing just what you're talking about, that opening chord progression. Is that what you're calling?
Yeah.
I want to make sure I'm saying this right. I'm being really careful.
Oh, no,
maybe
no.
Too careful, but I mean, out of respect for you, I want to make sure I'm saying the right things here. Man, I keep hearing that. It's almost like it's meditative, it's hypnotic. It's like I'm hearing it right now. I mean, literally, I'm hearing.
Thank you.
And I'm thinking it must be an imprint on my brain from last night. And it's just you know, it's not disturbing in a way that I can't concentrate on talking to you. But it's sort of kind of lightly just kind of playing in the background a little bit.
That's cool. That's cool. Thank you so much. Yeah, I appreciate that a whole lot. That's awesome. Yeah, I'm glad. And I saw the review that you did of Saints, and I really appreciate that too.
Oh, you bet. That
was great. Talking about the musicians that I met, you know. I was always just really a big fan of David Bowen. I found out Tacit had a gig in November of 2017. We played at the District House
over
there on the plaza, and it was kind of like a coffee shop. But we opened for a group called the Jazzed Up Collective. Is a group that's with Congo Mundunde, and David Bowen was playing drums during that time. And David heard us. And he heard me, and I got to hear him play, and I was just like, I really want to play with that guy, you know, because I was just like, that's amazing. The stuff that he's doing is just so intriguing.
Oh, yeah.
And in January, I got the courage to hit him up on Facebook, and I messaged him, and I just said, hey.
Wow.
And he has his own music, and he has stuff on Bandcamp as well that you can look at. And,
I didn't even know that.
Yeah,
oh my goodness!
He's a brilliant composer. Like he really is. Like and the thing is like the stuff that he was into was pretty much the same thing I was into, because he was doing a lot of that dissonance, avant garde, kind of you know, fusing of elements with that, you know, improv ethic.
Yeah,
you know, but he was also taking sampled sounds that he was taking and using that as a template for some, you know, improvisational kind of experiences, which is really cool. But he was very avant-garde, and some of it was really out there. What I liked is that there was still a tonal center, but there was also the sound in the background that was very dissonant. So you had the ability, because of those two things there, you could be within the key or you could go out as far as you wanted. And that's kind of what, and Miles Davis kind of did that, because they would be playing this really funky groove, and he would get on the OBX, and he would just play these, a good example of that, Speak.
Yeah.
There's an album called Speak, a song called Speak that he has. And it is just a really nasty, funky, like avant-garde, like, you know, atonal kind of a funk jam that they do. And, and I think that when I looked at a study of that, it was like there was no key center in it. So there's no key in it, and they can use play random stuff.
Wow. So yeah, you're like no limits, right?
You're totally free. And that's what I kind of liked about like with jazz. But like, we know with Dave, you know, he had all these tunes and everything. And in February, I got together with him, February of this year.
Wow.
And my second son was just born around in January. And so during that time, I was on paternity leave. And I got to hang out with him quite a bit. And we made music together. Basically, he had these tunes that he had recorded with the band that he played with in Texas, I think. You know, don't hurt me, Dave, if I said that wrong. But I think he had some guys in Texas that he played with.
And, yeah.
They recorded all this music. It was just so out there, and it was just so cool. Like, I never heard anything like it. But,
man.
So, when I got with him, I'm like, hey, I really like your stuff. Can we get together? He's like, yeah, man, let's get together. So, you know, we got together, and we just, you know, he had these songs, and he has, like, his own portable little studio that he takes with him
everywhere. Oh, wow.
Yeah, he has, like, this set of pedal boards and everything, and then he just has his laptop, and he just plugs everything in, and then he can run you through direct input, and you can just record over the stuff.
Interesting.
And so, and it's, like, a portable studio. So it was kind of cool. And so I did some solos on that, and I've shared them on Facebook, but it's on my SoundCloud account. Like, you know, you can look at some of the stuff that me and Dave, you know, some of the stuff I did with on Dave's track.
Yeah.
But my guitar sound, like, he did something to it to where it sounded almost cello-y, which I love. Like,
wow.
I really don't like that guitar sound, you know, that typical, like, Van Halen shred thing. If I can get it to sound a little less percussive,
yeah,
than what it is, then that's where I'm really kind of at, you know. But because I'm kind of gravitating away from the percussive sound. But
yeah,
so Dave really kind of captured that. But then I met Stephen Scholes.
Oh,
back in like June, and I heard about him, and I was always like crazy intimidated by him because he was just like this incredibly talented guy. But Dave was telling me all about him, and so Tacit had a gig, I think, in it was like right in the beginning, I think in May or June, or maybe in April, I can't remember, somewhere in that region in 2018, and Tacit had a gig, and we played at this jazz fest up there at the A-Loft.
Oh, wow.
And, it was a jazz fest, it seemed a little bit more like there was a blues act, and then there was a rap act, and then we were the only ones that were playing like Eddie Harris, and you know, we were the only ones doing that. So I was just like, okay, cool. But I wasn't going to say nothing. But
yeah,
you know, it was like, okay, cool. You know, I'm not being critical. It was just different. It was just a different vibe than what I was expecting. So I found out Stephen Scholes was covering on bass for that. The drummer reached out to him, and so Paul, he reached out to Stephen, and so Stephen. That's where I got to play with him for the first time, and I was just like, oh, wow,
man, that must have been an experience.
He blew my mind. Like, and he's an incredible guitarist, too. Like,
I had no idea.
Oh, he plays basically anything. Like, he's incredible. Just everything that he does is just awesome. I really love that guy a lot. Like, he's become a brother, man. So,
man, that's beautiful.
Yeah,
in fact, I think that night, actually, I think it was he playing electric bass when I saw you guys at Saints. And I was just, oh, man. And you and Dave, I've got to tell you, man, just the chemistry with you guys on stage, just the joy, the vibe of that. It's just this, it's almost in a way like there's a different layer. There's like, you know, there's what you guys are playing, but then there's this interpersonal thing that's going on that I don't know really what you call it. I don't know how to characterize it. It's so joyous, man.
Like to call it like, and this is kind of like the inspiration for my next album. I'm already working on my next album.
Oh, wow.
So I've got ideas, and I'm just trying to put it out there.
Yeah.
I really feel like, Jeremy Thomas, when you interviewed him, kind of talked about that outer body experience.
Oh, that was heavy. Man.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
Was heavy.
Well, I kind of feel like, this is kind of how I feel about it. Like, I kind of feel like in a way, like music, like that, or, you know, jazz musicians have this ability to make music almost as an interface. And there's a thing in I think it's string theory, or it's some field of theoretical physics, or I can't remember, because there's theoretical physics, and then there's quantum mechanics, and
yeah,
I can't remember, or I don't know if I'm saying quantum, I don't know if it's quantum mechanics or not, I don't know, but there's this theory where what we live in is a three-dimensional world, so we can go forwards, backwards, up, and down.
Right.
You have three-dimensional, you know, shapes like a cube, a sphere, you know, a cone,
yeah,
things like that, or pyramid. But there's also four-dimensional things that exist too.
Yeah.
So you get what's called like a tesseract or something like that. That's a four-dimensional image, but here's the problem, and this is what the scientists say. You're looking at a tesseract in a three-dimensional world, and it's a four-dimensional image.
Oh, yeah. How does that work?
And it's the only way that a three-dimensional being would be able to experience the fourth dimension or the fifth dimension was if a fourth dimensional being took him out, like kind of like a fish out of water. Because realm of water, that fish, that's his reality. He can swim forwards, backwards, up and down, but you take him out of water, and now he's gasping for breath, and it's like completely traumatizing to the, you know, if the fish has any kind of, you know, emotional. But it's the same thing. So scientists say, like, if a fourth dimensional being came and reached us, it would be like magic, almost. It would just be this incredible thing. But there's experiences, there's a movie called Interstellar, and they talked a lot about how, like, there are possibly like fourth dimensional expressions, like there's communication between the fourth dimension and the third dimension, and there's a way these beings communicate with us.
Yeah.
And or if they're real, or if there's, and one of them would be gravity, because gravity transcends time. And in the movie, it's really cool because, you know, the character, the guy, the scientist that goes out to go find another planet, he actually goes into a black hole and then somehow ends up in a tesseract, which that's science fiction. That wouldn't happen. Like, he'd just be obliterated if he went into a black hole. But he goes into a tesseract, which is a fourth dimensional thing, and he starts seeing his daughter, who he left to go on the mission. He sees her whole life right in front of him.
Wow.
And so he goes, he's floating, and he's behind the bookcase that's in her room, and he's pounding on the bookcase trying to get her attention to get her to stop him from going on the mission, because he knows he doesn't think he's ever going to come back.
Wow.
Basically. So he's pounding on the bookcase, and a book falls. And the book falls, and she turns and looks, and then a random thought comes in her head, and she's like, should I go get him? And that's what he was hoping for, but it didn't work.
Wow, man.
So anyway, the story, you know, I won't go into, I don't want to spoil it, but it basically ends really sad. But it was a really interesting. It was more about how like time is so brutal. It's just so brutal to people. Like time is just, you can't control it.
Yeah, can't escape it either.
You can't escape it. You know, it's just and that's kind of, so that's the interface concept of it. And to me, musicians have this ability to, when they have that outer body experience, to me that's almost like a fourth dimensional expression, an outer dimensional expression.
Man, I'll tell you what, I totally feel that. I mean,
you
it's
know,
like, yeah.
It's,
yeah.
And that's that, to me, that's that interface. Music is that interface to connect to. That's why when I talk to guys, I'm like, oh man, you're tapping into another dimension or something like that. You know, I'm like, I don't know what dimension he's tapping into, but it's really out there.
Yeah.
You know, because I don't think that there's possibly, you know, for, you know, third or fourth, fifth, sixth. They said there's about 11.
Yeah.
There could be like 11.1, 11.5, 11.2. You know,
kind of
like
fractional.
That. Fractional, you know?
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, if we're dealing with numbers, the numbers are endless. You know?
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that's kind of where science goes into. So I'm a bit of a nerd when it comes into that. But that's kind of how I felt about music, is that I felt like it was a bit like an interface in a way.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I get the sense that when I listen to what you do and the originality of this and the way that you bring this forth, that I have to wonder, would it be safe to say that it kind of, you could say almost that it gently removes you from, you know, instead of that, you know, reaching out and like really grab, you know, sometimes maybe it is more of like, you know, something reaches out and grabs you, but sometimes is it just kind of a gentle, you know, beckoning to maybe let yourself go to that different dimension.
It's just freedom, you know, and that's just when you have that much freedom. I mean, jazz really is like, to me, it's you know, it's democracy, you know, in a form of music, and that's kind of what everybody says, but so it's that asset. But really, I don't consider myself a jazz musician. I don't think I'm good enough. So that's why I was joking around with us last night. I'm like, I need to be careful. I'm playing impressions. I'm gonna get like in trouble, you know. But anyway,
yeah.
So there's that. But that's kind of the gist. And then you know, with the trumpet player, you know, Ryan Hatcher. And then the keyboardist, Dylan Chadone, I met them through kind of a gig that I do every Thursday in Stillwater at the College Bar. which gets packed with people.
Wow.
And I mean, it's more people than I've seen here in the city, you know, that come to a live show.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's neat, but it's kind of in that same kind of experience. But that's where I got Ryan and Dylan.
Oh,
and,
okay.
Because I met Dylan one time because he covered for the keyboard player, and Dylan just blew me away. I was just like, and he's only like, I think he just turned 21, so he's young.
Wow. But
he's incredibly talented, and you know, so that's, I was like, I need to get Ryan and Dylan in with the Saint Sessions too. And so, which I'm really glad you enjoyed that. That was,
oh man, it was incredible. That's incredible.
Thank you. Yeah.
And I definitely got to get over to Stillwater. That's on my list of yeah, because it's not that, it's a pretty easy drive, and
yeah
I definitely want to get over and see you guys over there too, man.
So yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. I think you like it, because you know, we do a lot of covers and stuff like that, and really people just go there to party and to be stupid. You know, the college kids do and everything.
Yeah.
I told you the story about the English woman that, you know, came up to me.
That was wild.
It was pretty crazy.
But it's wonderful to be appreciated, though, isn't it?
It was neat. It was just crazy. Like, you know, from England, and then they come to Oklahoma. Why? Like, you know,
yeah, it's like, what a culture shock.
Yeah, man, no, they were just the nicest people. But yeah, it's been a ride. Like I still feel like I'm learning, and I always want to learn.
Oh yeah,
because I feel like if I get to the point where I'm content with anything, then I'm never going to grow.
Yeah,
you know, I that's kind of how I feel about things, and that's why I'm just, a lot of guys joke with me, and they're like, you know, you're way too hard on yourself. But I can't help it. Like, I'm like, in my head, I'm just, I suck, you know.
I get it. It's that human element.
I'm like, God, I can't play nothing. You know, I just, it's like, I just need to give up. You know,
don't give up, man. Whatever you do, don't give up.
But so, I mean, you know, that's just kind of the gist of everything.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I appreciate it. I was going to ask you one last question. I don't want to put you on the spot, but, you know, after last night's performance, and it really felt like I was going on a ride somewhere. It felt like, you know, there was some sort of a vehicle taking me somewhere, still trying to iron out the details. And maybe I'll never know, and I'm totally cool with that as well. But I guess if I could ask you kind of in a nutshell, you know, if your music, if you feel like it is a vehicle, you know, what kind of vehicle is it? And then lastly, you know, where is it headed? Where is it, you know, where does it transport you to? And I know we've kind of talked about that a little bit.
Yeah, with the music that I have, I mean, to me, it's just me. You know, it's just me in a nutshell. And really, with the music that we did last night, it wasn't just me. Like, you know, it was Dave too, and
yeah,
then, you know, Joe, and then it's all of us. We all have these pieces. That's what I liked about, like, with We Eat Last. That's the project that I'm doing now, with David Bowen and Stephen Schultz and Dylan Chadone, and Ryan Hatcher. But basically, it's the music is a vehicle for improv, really.
Yeah.
But it's you know, you can, because we went to, like, straight ahead swing a couple of times.
Oh, it was beautiful.
Too, you know, but it was still that element of, like, you know, it's very electric.
Yeah.
Very, very out there.
Yeah.
You know, I was trying to tap into my inner Mike Stern, because, you know, Mike Stern is another guy that, like, very bebop based, but
yeah,
plays aggressive. You know, he can push on the distortion. He'll play bebop licks with distortion on and then just kill it.
Yeah.
And shred and everything. But so I try to tap into that, you know. But
yeah.
I would say, you know, that with the music that we're doing with Well, you know, it's definitely a vehicle for improvisation, I would say.
Yeah.
You know, I'm trying to improvise. I may not be doing a very good job, but I'm trying.
It's so beautiful, man.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the whole vehicle for it, as far as for Well goes.
Yeah.
As far as for my music, like the albums that you got, Dinner with the Greys and Analog Earth, you know, that just is going to continue. And with that music too, I recorded that by myself, and I played all the instruments on it. And produced it myself, yeah.
Wow.
And I got a graphic designer that made the logo for me.
That's very cool.
Thank you. Yeah. And so that music, I think, is going to continue to develop and morph into different things. With the kind of stuff that I'm looking at now, with, like, modern classical music, and, like, I got this really cool book that is, like, the holy grail of all things dissonant and avant-garde, that Nicholas Slonimsky's Thesaurus of Scales and Melodic Patterns.
Oh, man.
And that's actually the book that John Coltrane looked at and got a lot of ideas from. And that's the book that even Alan Holdsworth looked at and got a lot of ideas from.
Wow.
Like a lot of, and Frank Zappa got ideas from.
Man.
So it was a very influential book, and it was just kind of like this, you know, accepting to everybody. That's why Nicholas Slonimsky was so cool. He got accepted to play with Frank Zappa's band.
Wow.
And played with him live as a classical composer, and played with Frank Zappa on a Fender Rhodes.
Wow.
And it was incredible. Like, it was, and he talked about how much he loved Zappa. Like, he said, you know, Zappa was a big fan of Vareza, and so Zappa came up with these scores that were just huge, and they turned out to be just amazing pieces, you know.
Wow.
And even shot Slonimsky. So that's kind of where my music is heading, is kind of more into that, you know, how can I make, you know, that the world of kind of what I'm doing now, just take it a step further.
Yeah.
And then take it a little bit further into kind of more, even more out there stuff that's going to be even harder to listen to.
I'm ready to take that ride with you, man. I'm signing up.
Thanks, thank you so
Jared,
much.
Man, this has been fantastic. I was going to say, if anybody is interested, I'm just kind of putting this out there. I hope it's okay to say, but Bandcamp, is it? Bandcamp.com is where people can find Analog Earth and also Dinner with the Grays.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. Man, thank you again. This has been an absolute pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
Jeff, thank you so much.